From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As the war in Iraq continues, the White House has grown increasingly concerned that the news reported back home is only the bad news, filtered by major news organizations to exclude the positive developments on the road to Iraqi democracy. To circumvent the problem, the White House has been developing a government-run news network, what they call C-SPAN Baghdad. The network will feature a constant stream of whatever the U.S. government wants the U.S. public to see, press conferences, briefings, and, in all likelihood, very little coverage of military misfortunes. Joe Hagan broke this story last week in the New York Observer, and he joins us now to discuss it. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about legality for a moment. Some have suggested that this feed might be a violation of the Smith-Mundt Act, which prohibits the government from using Voice of America broadcasts that are aired abroad domestically, protecting Americans from American propaganda. It also raises the specter of a sort of state TV. Is this state TV?
It would be state TV if everybody had to watch it. It's a feed that can be picked up with the discretion of whoever is broadcasting. The creators of this have said that they're unhappy with the way the networks have been editing their news conferences and their daily highlights. They're hoping that this will be picked up without all of that editing, without the filter, quote unquote, possibly having the local affiliates air this stuff in a more uncut way. It really would depend, I suppose, if the local affiliates don't make it clear to their viewers that what they're seeing is a government-created press release and not necessarily something that's been vetted by journalists.
The government apparently is banking here that the local news stations who pick up this feed will be less discriminating and skeptical than the network news organizations that the White House is so troubled by. But is that a fair assumption? Local news stations weren't all that pliant a few weeks ago when the president gave them interviews with the same intentions to avoid the filtration factor.
The difference is that local affiliates don't typically have access to a lot of foreign coverage like this. I mean, if you give an affiliate in Denver the opportunity to interview Paul Bremer or have access to a feed that is showing you some developments in Baghdad, you might be interested in taking that opportunity because local affiliates don't typically have people on the ground in Baghdad. They don't have the budgets for it.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. At a minimum, it seems that this feed will provide local stations in particular, but the American public at large, more information on a 24-hour basis about what is going on in Iraq. In general, isn't more information better than less information, more access better than less?
This is a way of controlling access. You can control information. If you own the camera through which all of the press conferences are being beamed, as it stands, the CPA will try to hold a press conference and some people will show up with cameras and they're sort of picky and choosy about, you know, whether they want those cameras on sometimes, you know, when they're having a press conference that is on the record or off the record. And in a way, this gives them even more control over that kind of thing.
The CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, has compared C-SPAN Baghdad to the CENTCOM briefings from Doha, Qatar during the major part of the war when the press convened there to find out the daily developments in the war. Is that a fair analogy?
I don't think so at all, because the CENTCOM press conferences were created from a pool of all the different equipment and satellites of the various networks and cable operations. This is operating with a camera owned by the CPA, purchased by taxpayers, and completely contained and controlled by the agency that is beaming it.
Well, let me once again jump to defend the administration. All White Houses, all governments have been dissatisfied with the way the media have covered them. And they all think that the press is unnecessarily skeptical and unnecessarily critical, insufficiently sympathetic to the goals of the administration. Isn't this just a case of the technology having caught up to all administrations' desire to get as unfiltered a message as possible out to the American people?
The stakes and the consequences are so much higher in this situation than they are in, say, during the Clinton administration. We're talking about a radical foreign policy move that the president has made, and there's a lot at stake in making it successful, both politically and obviously with lives of American soldiers on the line. So this is making it even more of a urgent situation for them to make sure that they control the message, that they counterspin what they think is being spun by the mainstream media.
When a government is in the news distribution business, isn't that almost by definition then propaganda?
There's a lot of question as to whether that's what this is going to be. It really depends on what they end up beaming through it, and it also depends on whether they limit access. If they limit access and they only beam through good news stories, if they put on some sort of feel-good programming while there are helicopters crashing, you could characterize it as propaganda.
All right, Joe. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Hagan is a staff writer for the New York Observer.
Under the Taliban, Afghanistan had no media to speak of. It was a regime that forbade free expression, be it through music, literature, or shaving. So when the Taliban finally fell, there was a veritable explosion of magazines, newspapers, even broadcast outlets. Pakistani author Ahmed Rashid saw the need for a sustained program of support for the burgeoning Afghan media and used a quarter of the profits of his best-selling book, Taliban, to kickstart an organization called the Open Media Fund for Afghanistan. So far, the OMFA has funded 14 publications, both in Kabul and the outlying provinces. There's a weekly newspaper with a circulation of 17,000, the highest in the country, and a woman's magazine. And there's even an Afghan version of the British satirical journal, Private Eye. Wahid Warasta manages the day-to-day operations of the OMFA in Kabul. Mr. Warasta, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Can you give me an example of a report that one of your publications printed that seemed to have made a difference?
Yeah. One of our publications in the city of Khost, which was one of the Al-Qaeda areas, Mazal Weekly was established in that province with our financial support, was the first independent and free publication in the province. In its first and second issues, it directly started criticizing the governor in that province and some other authorities. It came under pressure directly by the governor, and it was reported to me. I went to the Minister of Information and Culture, and he wrote an open letter addressed to the governor of that province, asking him not to bother and harass the journalists there. So it helped other journalists so much that even after our publication, another publication started in that province, and the editor of that publication was again under pressure. And at that time, the editor of our funded publication went and negotiated with the authorities there and solved the problem there. So now the problems are reducing in that province.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
What I'm curious about is the satirical publication that you fund. Are you feeling any pressure from the government when you take them on, when you lampoon ministers?
Yeah, our very successful publication, Zambele Gham, which is the satirical publication, sometimes has come under pressure from some of the party authorities. But at the moment, the Karzai government seems to be open to criticism, as it has expressed commitment to support freedom of expression. But most of our publications are receiving sometimes anonymous threat letters, including this satirical publication, and sometimes are directly threatened by an authority. The biggest problem in Afghanistan is that no one can write against religion. You can criticize politicians, you can criticize leaders, you can write about politics or anything else. It doesn't mean that you won't be threatened. You will be threatened, but it won't be as dangerous as writing against religion.
What are the consequences of writing against religion?
Based on the Islam religion, anyone speaking against Islam should be sentenced to death.
And have those sentences been carried out, or is there just a fear that they could be?
No, I haven't been carried out, but just a fear. But in the history of Afghanistan, self-censorship is the main problem that starts by journalists themselves. I mean, if 50% the authorities are threatening, 50% the journalists themselves are also to blame for not using their courage.
How easy is it to ask people, though, to find the courage if the consequences of being courageous could possibly be death?
If they don't take risks, it will be very difficult to go ahead. It's a fight. We should continue this fight. We may sometimes sacrifice our lives, but no problem.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Yes, please.
You seem to be a very young man. Can I ask how old you are?
Yeah, 26.
So you've never had any direct experience of a free press, have you, in your own country?
In fact, I come from a cultural family where my brother, Dr. Abdul Sami Ahmed, is one of the very famous poets and journalists in Afghanistan who has always been very courageous in expressing what he wants to express, and he has received physical threats and tortures. During the communist regime, I remember him being arrested and tortured by the intelligence of the communist regime. But he again resisted and resisted. I have been born so courageous because of my brother. He has been the teacher of my courage.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Waheed Warasta manages the day-to-day operations of the Open Media Fund for Afghanistan.
Coming up, Congress stares down the FCC, sort of, and when sex in the media was new and educational, sort of.
Remember, you can get free transcripts of the show and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, as part of an omnibus spending bill that funds the FCC and other governmental agencies, congressional Republicans in the White House agreed on a TV ownership cap of 39%. This number represents a compromise between the 45% limit that the FCC had set this summer and the 35% limit decided by lawmakers after the public uproar over the FCC's action. But who exactly was compromising? Democrats were excluded from the negotiation, and some of them are howling, as, of course, are the media advocacy watchdogs accustomed to baying at the moon on this issue. One of those hounds is Jeffrey Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy, and he joins me from Washington, D.C. Jeff, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
Senators and congressmen, Republicans and Democrats, had already hashed out a number, 35%, in their conference committee. Where did the 39% figure come from all of a sudden?
The four television networks were putting a lot of pressure on both the Bush White House and the Congress, particularly the Senate, to come to some compromise over the TV ownership cap. President Bush had threatened to veto the entire omnibus spending bill. And as unbelievable as that might seem, it would grind the entire government to a halt. It was a credible threat. And so the chief sponsor of the TV cap legislation in the Senate, Senator Stevens, agreed to a deal.
This had all been hashed out earlier in the conference committee. Fritz Hollings, the South Carolina Democrat, said, quote, "The Republicans went into a closet, met with themselves, and announced a compromise." He seems to be rightfully, righteously indignant over this. But on the other hand, the Democrats say they're shocked that the terms would suddenly change after the deal was struck. But is this really such an unusual development by Capitol Hill standards?
Look, there was always going to be a deal on media ownership. I think the good news is this issue is not going away. Democrats and some Republicans have said they will bring up the TV ownership issue and the other media policy FCC issues when Congress reconvenes. So you are facing some kind of showdown.
I couldn't help but notice that this new 39% figure will keep both Rupert Murdoch's Fox Broadcasting and Viacom CBS just under the limit, which would mean they won't have to divest themselves of stations. coincidence?
No, the real reason they picked the number 39 was because the White House had agreed to help the networks with their lobbying goal. Fox and Viacom CBS don't want to divest. They're already above the limit. And both NBC and ABC want to buy more stations. So 39 was a perfect number for them. It's still a big victory in the sense that the networks lobbied the FCC and indeed are still going to court saying there shouldn't be any limit whatsoever, that a television network should be able to buy as many stations as they want to buy, either in a community or across the country. So 39 is still a significant defeat for them.
Well, presumably, though, it will be more difficult for the networks to prevail in court with respect to the law of the land than it would over just some FCC regulation.
Yeah, the networks have been tremendously successful in court because they've gone in and said, look, the FCC came up with these numbers and these rules in an arbitrary fashion. But now, for the first time, potentially, you'll have the Congress setting the limit.
So as a media advocacy watchdog yourself, although I guess the non-negotiated negotiation must chafe, all in all, not a bad deal compared to where we were back in the summer?
Well, who would have imagined that Jeff Chester and the other public interest advocates would be standing alongside Trent Lott, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, and the National Rifle Association protecting our nation's media and democracy? We've made tremendous strides. It's become a front burner issue, almost a front page A section story instead of in the back of newspapers. So there's been a tremendous, I think, a consciousness raising across the country and across the political spectrum that media concentration is truly a problem and needs to be addressed.
Well, Jeff, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jeffrey Chester watches the FCC as executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. His book, Digital Destiny, will be published by the New Press in 2004. As a holiday treat, we're devoting the rest of the show to an examination of the symbiosis of media and sex, specifically how the media are used to advance ideas about sex and sex education, and how sex is used in turn to advance media technology. And we'll start with a quick look back to the publication of the landmark Kinsey Report. The first part, issued in 1948, dealt with sexuality in the human male. The second part, 5 years later, with the human female. The two studies resounded like a thunderclap across America, bringing sex education programs like this in its wake.
He's been awfully worried lately, so my husband says, about his own sex activity.
By which I suppose you mean either his dreams and emissions at night or his urge to stimulate himself?
It's both, I guess. He seems to feel he's getting out of control or something.
It was about this time when Kroger Babb, sex educator cum snake oil salesman, enters the scene. His snake oil, a movie disarmingly titled Mom and Dad, was supposed to expose the consequences of sexual ignorance, to fire angry rounds of accusation straight into the living rooms of middle America.
Who was the boy? I'll have him arrested.
Dave didn't tell me his name, and I didn't ask. After all, why blame the boy?
But you wouldn't blame such a scandalous thing on an innocent young girl like Joan.
No, I wouldn't blame her any more than I would the boy.
Well, then who would you blame?
I'd blame you, Mrs. Blake. You and every parent who neglects the sacred duty of telling their children the real truth.
Joe Bob Briggs is an author, an erstwhile TV movie host, and a columnist for UPI. He recently wrote about Mom and Dad and Kroger Babb for Reason magazine, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So first, I wonder if you can set the scene for us. Tell me about the venues that Mom and Dad played in. I mean, these were less multiplex-type movie screenings than they were medicine shows.
They were small-town shows that were similar to a carnival or the circus. It was a type of film called a sex hygiene film that was actually, Mom and Dad was not the first of them, but Mom and Dad was just the greatest of all of them. If you lived in a small town in the 40s or 50s or even 60s, because this movie ran for 30 years, sooner or later, publicity man would show up in town and ads would appear and a debate would occur and there would be letters to the editor in the paper. You would get all the ballyhoo leading up to the one-week only screenings of Mom and Dad, Kroger Babb billed himself as America's fearless young showman. And he had an army of these Mom and Dad roadshow units that went all over the country, at one time as many as 40 of them on the road all at the same time.
And as part of his advance strategy, he would sometimes write the angry letters to the editor, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was the master at writing fake letters to the editor, posing as a pastor in another town that had already had Mom and Dad and saying, never let this film show there. They would also occasionally try to get court injunctions filed against their own film. You know, and one time they were successful, and then they had to go into court and argue against their own injunction. But, yeah, anything to create controversy about the film.
And so when the projector rolled, what exactly would the audience see?
The whole first hour is devoted to showing how this sweet, pretty young girl has her life ruined because she goes to a local dance and she's swept off her feet by a handsome and worldly pilot who steals a kiss, and then he overwhelms her after that in his roadster on Lover's Lane and convinces her that two people as much in love as they are should definitely go all the way. Slow fade, okay?
Right.
Shortly thereafter, he leaves town on business. Then she gets a letter that he's been killed in an accident on the same day that she discovers she's worried about her hygiene.
In other words, she is in trouble, in trouble, in trouble. That phrase is used throughout the film. The P word, however, is never invoked.
Never use the word pregnancy in the entire film.
Now, the truly titillating material, though, the stuff that everybody was really there to see, was actually tucked deep in the show and arrives in the form of a film within a film?
Yeah. In one of the clumsiest segues ever, one of the teachers at the high school says, we need a class in social hygiene so these things don't happen again. And somebody mentions, oh, I know this specialist, Dr. Ashley. And the next scene you see Dr. Ashley talking to a high school class of girls, and he shows a film called The Facts of Life. And it looks, you know, just like a normal film about the menstrual cycle, and it has some drawings of the genital organs. And then, whap, suddenly, without warning, graphic footage of a live birth. Then you haven't quite recovered from that, and they show a second film called Modern American Surgery that has an actual cesarean section on camera. Then, two scenes later, just when you think you've seen all you can see, there's a third film within the film called Seeing is Believing, and this is the coup de grace of the whole thing. It's every teenage boy's nightmare. It's got all these syphilis victims with their rotting teeth and their bodies with open sores and all these silent movie-style captions that say, the price of ignorance. Self-styled moralists would like to keep these facts a secret, things of this nature.
You know, what's interesting about Mom and Dad is that it allowed moviegoers to get off on images of Pickles and Beaver, as they were known, and yet still walk away with their sense of moral integrity intact.
And now, friends, you've seen the entire production. If you agree that these pictures have been bold and shocking enough, that you've learned a very worthwhile lesson from them, I wish you'd show the management your appreciation at this time by your applause.
Notice that he says two things that are contradictory. He says, if you believe these things are bold and shocking, and if you believe these things are educational, show the management by your applause. And, of course, that was the genius of the promotion, that you could appeal to a man's baser instincts and yet let him justify seeing this footage by his educational mission.
Well, Joe Bob Briggs, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Joe Bob Briggs is the author of Profoundly Disturbing, The Shocking Movies That Changed Cinema. 2003 marked the golden anniversary of an American institution, although it wasn't always an institution. In the early days, when Eisenhower's roamed the earth, Playboy magazine was a phenomenon for the very reason that it challenged the institutions of government and cultural propriety. In a pinched post-war America, Playboy celebrated spending. In an era of sexual repression, it made hedonism the ism of choice for the nation's elite. And by the way, it's still the leading men's magazine in the world.
The 27-year-old Hugh Marston Hefner produced the first issue of Playboy at his kitchen table. He even drew the cartoons himself. There was no cover date because he didn't know if there would be a second issue, as no one had ever dared to challenge the anti-obscenity laws of the U.S. Post Office by distributing nude pictures through the mail as a commercial venture. We'll hear from Hef in a moment, but first we asked author Gay Talese to assess Playboy's impact on American society, a topic he explored in the 1981 book Thy Neighbor's Wife. He says that what distinguished Playboy was not nudity per se, but how the nudity was deployed.
Before there was Playboy, there were nudist magazines. One of the best known was Sunshine and Health. But those people in Sunshine and Health, the women, and there were men in Sunshine and Health, they were airbrushed, and they were also not necessarily attractive people. The whole point of the nudist magazine was to say to the reader, nudity is not ludity. What was important about Playboy was that the nude model, invariably a good-looking young woman, was looking at the camera and ergo making contact with the reader. And there was a kind of an illicit relationship between the man who is the consumer, the reader, and the woman who is the exhibitionist on the glossy pages of Playboy.
Now, America in the 50s was an America of I Like Ike and the Red Scare and the man in the gray flannel suit, and was certainly pre-sexual revolution. What impact did Playboy have on the culture?
Hefner, in the 1950s, introduced into middle America a sense that women, with their clothes off, belonged in our lives, and they were okay. And that was the big thing, in the beginning at least, of Playboy's contribution to popular culture. What it did was bring to the jury system a diminution of being shocked by nudity, because they'd seen so much of it. All that nudity that Playboy extended into small towns and restricted areas and into home life, it gave a kind of a sense of being blasé toward the nude female form, so that when they, in pornography cases, voted whether to or whether not to punish a person who was brought up on charges of obscenity, they tended to acquit rather than convict.
But did the legal decisions that resulted from the anti-smut prosecutions by the postal inspectors and other agencies, did they extend beyond the issue of pornography into other areas of free speech?
They most certainly did. The dirty work was done by the pornographer. It wasn't done by Alfred A. Knopf or Random House or the Library Association of America. They did nothing in terms of free speech, nothing in terms of freedom of expression. It's because the smut peddlers took the beating in the courts. They fought the government. They fought the Catholic Legion of Decency. They fought the moral code, and they made it open for Arthur Miller, Philip Roth, John Updike, Joyce Carol Oates. They all owe to the smut peddler their freedom. Hefner is a major figure in fighting against repression, and that means any kind of repression. It isn't just the right to show naked women or naked men or whatever. That's part of it. But if you can show naked women, naked men, you can show a lot of nakedness in terms of language. You don't have to worry about putting a fig leaf on a verb, don't you see?
I want to ask you about Playboy Advisor, and which told you what stereo to buy and how to mix a martini, and the Playboy interviews, which went in-depth as mainstream journalism seldom did, with very important cultural and political figures, and all of the things that are not the pictures of naked women that have defined Playboy. Were these fabulous contributions to journalism ever anything fundamentally more than a delivery system for soft porn?
Obscenity, in order to be not obscene, has to have redeeming social value. So Playboy had, in addition to the naked women we all might have lusted for, redeeming social value in the form of a lot of boring interviews with Noam Chomsky that was there in the pages of Playboy. There were good writers, Irwin Shaw in the old days, and Norman Mailer, and John Updike, I mentioned again, and Joyce Carol Oates. But you take those girls and you banish them to Siberia, and Mr. Hefner and Playboy with him goes into receivership. He's out of business. He's back in Chicago without a swimming pool, without a jacuzzi, with nothing.
So if you happen to have a copy of Playboy, will you walk down the street with it in your hand, or will you shove it into your briefcase?
Let me tell you where I stand with Playboy. I don't read it. I never read it. I never have published a piece in it. I've never submitted an article to be published in Playboy. Okay? My defense of Playboy is because Playboy made my life and the life of every writer easier.
Well, Gay Talese, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Garfield.
Gay Talese is the author of Unto Thy Sons, The Kingdom and the Power, and Thy Neighbor's Wife.
Coming up, a few words from Hef and the impact of porn on communications technology.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And now we present the living embodiment of all things Playboy, the Knight of the Round Bed and the Silk PJs, Hugh Hefner. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's an amazing thing you did, weaving together a passion for literature, civil rights, runny cheeses, and big breasts into what you call a viable aesthetic.
And it was an attempt to incorporate, in a positive way, a sexuality into the rest of the kinds of interests that a person spends their time on when they're not working. Our notion of playing hard was largely bowling and watching television, and there was more to life than that. I think that, you know, our traditional values, and they're rooted in our religious values, has pitted mind and body against one another, the notion that the devil is in the flesh. I didn't buy it when I was young. I don't buy it now.
But Playboy's tastes were so expensive. I mean, wasn't the Playboy philosophy therefore a little exclusive?
Well, obviously it wasn't. Some of the dreams and some of the gadgets were out of reach, but part of the magazine, both its sexuality and also related to consumerism, was a fantasy. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for? It's a motivation to dream.
In the Playboy philosophy, you quote from one of your most eloquent critics, Harvey Cox, who wrote a piece that was reprinted in various Christian journals of opinion and college newspapers. Can I read you his quote?
Sure, of course.
Moralistic criticisms of Playboy fail because its anti-moralism is one of the few places in which Playboy is right. Thus, any theological critique of Playboy that focuses on its lewdness will misfire completely. Playboy and its less successful imitators are not sex magazines at all. They dilute and dissipate authentic sexuality by reducing it to an accessory, by keeping it at a safe distance. And he concludes with, "We must see in Playboy the latest and slickest episode in man's continuing refusal to be fully human."
Well, I think that's very sophisticated semantics, but not very accurate. I mean, the reality is that far from being accessories, the romantic relationship between the sexes, expressed from a male point of view, is what Playboy is all about. It's what makes the world go around. The fine food and wine and the clothes and the cars and the gadgetry, those are the accessories. But the part that really matters is the connection between the opposite sex.
Here's a clip that we borrowed from your A&E biography. It's you being challenged by feminist Susan Brownmiller on the Dick Cavett Show. And we'll run that now.
The role that you have selected for women is degrading to women because you choose to see women as sex objects. You make them look like animals, yes. Women aren't bunnies. They're not rabbits. They're human beings. The day that you are willing to come out here with a cottontail attached to your rear end...
We've been accused, obviously, of exploiting women, exploiting sex. I think Playboy exploits sex. You know, I just think exploit is an unfortunate word. Playboy exploits sex like Sports Illustrated exploits sport.
Now, I noticed that you never responded to her specific challenge about the bunny tails. I mean, it would, after all, be antithetical to the Playboy aesthetic to attach a little fuzzy ball of cotton to your own tush, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think so.
But is that fair?
And that feminist diatribe didn't make a lot of sense back then. It seems very foolish today. I think that in the intervening years, women really have become truly human. That anti-sexual part of feminism is very antiquated and, quite frankly, was anti-revolutionary even at the time. To be truly human, women have to embrace their sexuality. And that's all Playboy's really all about. I think it's one of the reasons why the magazine and the Playboy symbols and why the rabbit image are so popular now with young women. And you see Playboy fashions in all the leading women's magazines. We have come a long ways, baby.
I think that's true, but I do think that some of that Playboy style that you're referring to, the bunny costumes, have certainly something to do with kitsch. And what's more, back in the early days when you were creating that costume and that image, it wasn't women expressing their own sexuality. It was women putting on the costume that you had designed for them. This wasn't them embracing their own sexuality. This was them embracing yours.
True.
So,
that's right. That's what makes it work.
But then doesn't Susan...
You're thinking about the opposite sex. I think that's what it's all about.
I don't want to spend a lot of time in this space arguing the fine points of feminism here. Certainly, these things can be approached with a greater sense of humor today when women have far more equality in every sphere, including the sexual sphere. But it could, at the time, certainly seem as if they were being put into a little bunny box.
Well, it seems so, obviously, to some people who... expressed those views, you know, in a political context, but didn't have much to do with reality.
Well, let's jump ahead to Playboy today. Playboy, as we said, is still the largest circulation men's magazine in the world, but here in the United States, magazines like Maxim are giving it a real run for its money. And the editors of Maxim say that one of its advantages is that it has no nudity, so men aren't embarrassed to buy it and carry it around.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. They get more advertising support and they get greater distribution. That's absolutely true. And that's a reflection of the fact that still in America, we do have rather unsophisticated attitudes towards sexuality and nudity.
Why do you think Playboy's circulation has declined from its peak of, what, 7 million back in 1972?
Well, I think that one has to think of it in a time frame. I mean, the 7 million circulation, which we reached in the early 1970s, was before video, before more explicit sexuality in many, many forms. It was a brief moment in history. The magazine circulation has been over 3 million for now for the last 20 years. So the magazine is very, very vital. But there are new forms of competition out there, and particularly the laddie books, Maxim and FHM and magazines like that, that are really kind of a downscale version of Playboy instead of the girls and the champagne, the babes and the beer. But like all the rest of the men's field, they are all variations really on Playboy. I think one of the remarkable things about the magazine is how much the readers connected with it, that it became for them more than just a magazine. It became a projection of really who they felt they wanted to be. And men look back now, and women too, on those first issues and when they first saw them in their adolescence. And it became and continues to be a kind of a rite of passage from adolescence into adulthood.
Can you say anything about how the image of the Playboy bunny has evolved? Has she changed? I mean, does she still find walks on the beach a turn-on and mean people a turn-off?
Probably. some things in terms of humankind don't change that much.
What are you wearing?
Pajamas, of course.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Hugh Hefner started the Playboy Revolution 50 years ago.
As we consider sex in the media, we should keep in mind that whenever there's a breakthrough in communications technology, pornography seems to play a pivotal role. There are many crucial implications here for the broader issues of morality, sexuality, child protection, and censorship. But to our future letter writers, we say in advance we won't be addressing those right now. Instead, we offer a brief history, first broadcast about this time last year, of pornography as an engine of technological progress.
This month, humanity crossed a communications Rubicon. Scientists at the MIT Touch Lab in Boston sent a physical sensation across the ocean to another scientist in London who was wearing a glove attached to a computer. It was brief, a flickering in the fingertip, but it was real. When we called the scientists, they bristled at the very idea that their achievement could have a sexual application. But history suggests that communications technology and pornography are as closely linked as a hand in a glove. Erotic engravings were traded throughout the ancient world, but it wasn't much of a business. Being that the business of pornography is business, it had to wait for the printing press.
After Gutenberg, in the 1500s, you actually have the first known writer making his living by writing pornography, though you might call it erotica then because it was still fairly expensive, a gentleman by the name of Pietro Aretino.
Jonathan Coopersmith, who teaches at Texas A&M, conducted exhaustive research into the matter for his paper called Pornography, Technology, and Progress. After movable type, he says the next great leap came centuries later with the development of photography. Now you didn't even have to know how to read.
An example, 1874, the London police raid a pornographer and they seize 130,248 obscene photographs.
Yowza. Now,
that's a huge amount of paper that's being consumed. In that sense, pornography is helping the distribution, helping the economic viability of photography.
And 20 years later, the pictures began to move. Imagine the viabilities.
In 1894, you have the first public movie. 1896, 2 years later, you have the first pornographic film. And ever since then, you've had more pornographic films produced than non-pornographic films.
In 1977, the very first pre-recorded videotape to go on sale was pornographic. It took another year for a non-porn tape to hit the market. And how about those clumsy camcorders, those expensive, unreliable early VCRs? Who bought those? Do-it-yourselfers, says Coopersmith, which explains why even the earliest models had a low light adjuster.
If you think about it, there are very few children's birthday parties which are really done with very low levels of light.
There are a couple of theories for why Sony Betamax, the superior video technology, lost the battle against the VHS format developed by JVC. For one thing, Sony was slow to license its technology, but perhaps just as important, pornographers preferred the cheaper, more convenient VHS format, which drove the market for tapes and players.
A lot of new technology goes through what's been referred to as the porn phase because it's kind of a proving ground for technology.
Brian Michaels is currently marketing a handy new service called Pocket Joy, which we'll get to in a moment.
You don't have to get big sponsorships to sponsor your new technology in order to keep your business afloat while you kind of prove it out. Instead, you put adult content on it. People pay a premium for that adult content, and that's enough to sustain your business while you build a better business case for other types of content.
There's certain experiences you can have in the world commercially that are free.
Author Douglas Rushkoff writes on culture and the internet.
You know, you can get free saltines. You can get a free sample of laundry detergent. You know, you can get a free, maybe a picture of a woman's breasts. But when push comes to shove, when you're going to want to see real sex or get liquor or have a vice experience, you end up having to pay.
For a long time, sex was the only commodity that sold on the internet. And while other services continue to crash and burn, pornography profitably smolders on. Ask former stripper, now internet mogul, Danny Ash. When she got sick of the road, she took to the net. She had great pictures to sell, and other models joined her. Now she's a multimillionaire. She remembers when streaming video was new and bulky, and porn sites developed their own technology.
The adult entertainment industry was the first to use streaming JPEG push video, which was video that worked in web, in the browser, and didn't require a plugin. I think as an industry, we tend to jump in a little bit faster and tweak the technology and try to get it work faster.
And in any case, says Brian Michaels of Pocket Joy, which I said we'll get to in a minute, consumers of porn tend to be more patient than the average Joe.
I would say that a user would spend about 30 seconds trying to figure out how to view a clip from a baseball game, whereas they may spend 2 or 3 minutes trying to figure out how to view a video clip of an erotic situation. And then they're going to go and tell all of their friends how they did it.
I asked Danny Ash what she saw as the next frontier in high-tech porn.
There's a lot of talk about third-generation wireless stuff.
Cell phones.
Yes, about broadband cell phones, because you'll have all of that privacy and access that the Internet afforded you, but now you'll have mobility. So you don't have to sit in front of your desktop to watch the material. You can take it anywhere you'd like to be, anywhere that's more comfortable for you.
PocketJoy.com is a wireless internet webpage delivering full-color erotic images and jokes to the internet-capable mobile phone.
I told you we'd get to it. Brian Michaels says the service is up now, and when the technology to deliver moving pictures arrives, PocketJoy will be the first to use it.
Sure, we're talking about 1-minute dirty movies, 30-second dirty movies, 5-minute dirty movies, things of all types.
Pictures on film, on the net, on the phone, where does that leave radio on the technological frontier? Satellite radio is offering all sorts of new formats to specially equipped cars. Like basic cable, you have to pay a fee. But now, XM Satellite Radio is testing the waters with Playboy Radio for an additional cost of $2.99 a month. It will be the first premium service ever offered on satellite radio.
Did you get laid last night?
Nope.
Liar.
I did not.
She's such a
I did
here's,
not.
Here's one rule of thumb. Don't ever lie to our listeners.
Steve Gavanis is Executive Vice President for Programming for XM Satellite Radio.
It went on officially on September 3rd of this year, and we have very strong demand for it. There's a lot of people who spend a lot of time in their vehicles, a lot of time alone in their vehicles. There's a large male contingent, a lot of truck drivers among our early adopters. So when you kind of roll it all up and assess the attractiveness of the content to what percent of the population of subscribers relative to the cost of acquiring the content or creating the content, you know, this does seem to be a natural starting place.
Basically, a very simple combination of two attractive young women sitting around talking dirty.
Well, I think that's a pretty good way to summarize.
If porn were a person with such a record of fueling technological progress, he would merit an award from, at the very least, the Chamber of Commerce. Because as far as driving the modern economy is concerned, porn is better than sex. Douglas Rushkoff.
This is an interesting one. Cowboys in the 1800s in America would pay more for a picture of a naked woman than they would to have sex with a prostitute. If a cowboy would pay more for a picture of a girl than for sex with the girl, then the picture of the girl has something that real sex doesn't. Repeatability, it has safety, it can't laugh at you, it can't tease you.
Technology has always isolated us, says Rushkoff. That's why we crave better and better technology, to occupy those lonely hours with flights into the unknown.
I would argue that what really drives technology and interactive technology is not the recreation of experiences that we can have in real life, but the invention of experiences that we can't have in real life. And that's when you see the real leaps forward.
Inevitably, then, the fingertip touch the scientists experienced this month will blossom into a full-blown bodysuit. In fact, there are companies working on that right now. That will be the moment when communications technology fulfills its ultimate potential to connect us entirely, antiseptically, and without fear of judgment or rejection with the person we most desire.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.